Looking at our world from a theological perspective. This is the Theology Central Podcast, making theology central.
Good morning, everyone. It is Sunday, October the 24th, 2021. It is currently 9:14 a.m. Central Time, and I'm coming to you live from the empty sanctuary of Victory Baptist Church right here in Ovalo, Texas. And because it's 9:14 a.m. Central Time, that means most likely I should not have turned on the microphone and went live because, well, we start Sunday school at 10 a.m., but I could not resist. I was telling myself, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. But here I am. I'm live on the air. So we're going to probably just be able to get a very brief introduction here to this subject. But this subject, in a sense, is going to be talked about at 10 a.m. for the Sunday school hour. So maybe this kind of serves as an introduction. Let's begin this. If you've been paying, well, let's begin with this. See, I need to actually complete my words and not cut myself off. Okay, but I'm in a hurry because I know I have a limited amount of time. See, I know I made a bad decision. All right, here we go. We have been doing a Bible study exercise on 1 John. Hopefully, you've been participating in that Bible study exercise. Even if you haven't been doing the assignments and using the curriculum, hopefully, you've been at least listening to all of our study through 1 John. And we've raised lots of important questions. We've really challenged how to understand the book of 1 John. I think it's a polemic against Gnosticism. I think many people completely they assign a purpose to the book that I don't think is accurate. And so we've really been looking at that and raising lots of important questions. But we have reached a point in our study of 1 John where we have to deal with a very, very important passage of Scripture and a very important concept. And that is found in 1 John chapter 3, verse 9, where we read this word. Whoever is born of God doth not commit sin, for his seed remaineth in him, and he cannot sin because he is born of God. I want you to hear that again. 1 John 3, 9. Whosoever is born of God doth not commit sin, for his seed remaineth in him, and he cannot sin because he is born of God. Now, how do we understand that verse? How has that verse been understood throughout church history? What are the different methods of trying to interpret that verse? That's what we're going to be looking at starting at 10 o'clock. We're going to continue the Bible study exercise, and we're going to be looking at this verse. We're going to look at least seven or nine. Everything is up on the pulpit. I believe I have seven different ways that people have tried to interpret this verse. That's what we're going to be looking at 10 a.m. But for right now, here's what happened. I was sitting here looking at everything, and I saw a title for a podcast episode called Sinless Christianity. And I'm like, whoa, wait. And in this episode, what they are doing is they're reviewing a sermon where someone, I guess, is putting forth this idea that there can be basically sinless Christianity, that there can be Christians who do not sin. And I'm like, well, this is very relevant. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to jump right into this podcast episode. We're going to hear what they're talking about. This comes from Issues ETC or Issues, etc. They're interviewing Chris Rosebro, where he's doing his weekly feature called This Week in Pop Christianity, where he takes some time to look at what's going on within the Christian world, and he talks about it. So obviously, he came across something dealing with this idea of sinless Christianity. It fits in perfect with what we're going to be doing at the 10 o'clock hour. And so we'll at least introduce this, and then I don't know if I'll be back this afternoon if I can. At some point, we'll have to complete this. Yeah, see, I'm starting another series, and I don't really want this to be a series, but it's going to have to be. But we'll at least get this started. I think it will really lead right into the 10 o'clock hour, so I think this is a perfect idea. I think it is. We'll see. We'll see if it all works together. But are you ready? Issues ETC. Chris Rosebro from Fighting for the Faith. He came across something talking about this idea of sinless Christianity. We have 1 John chapter 3, where a lot of people will try to take this idea from there. I think there's a lot of Christians, even if they don't go as far as maybe what, you know, they don't take 1 John 3:9. And I think this is a very important concept. Yeah, 1 John 3:9. make sure I'm in James. I'm like, what just happened? I'm like, that verse does not look correctly. Yeah, 1 John 3:9. I think there's a lot of people who don't take 1 John 3:9 maybe like as literal as it appears, but they still have kind of a modified idea of a sinless Christianity, because I know Christians who go to a relatively decent church who really seems to have the idea that we can stop sinning, that we can. Yeah, now, they may say, well, you know, it may be impossible to be perfect, but they still want to give the idea that it is at least maybe it's attainable by someone. And when people out there believe that you can just completely stop sinning, well, we've got a major issue, because we've got 2,000 years of church history demonstrating that we've never experienced sinless Christianity. And I've never met a sinless Christian, including the one talking to you right now. And I'm sure that all the people I'm talking to, none of you have ever been sinless. And if you think you are, that's probably a sin, because you're in denial and you're lying to yourself. So, yeah, so let's see how they handle this subject and how they introduce it, and we'll see how this all fits together for the 10 o'clock hour. Let's jump in and see how far we can get. Here we go.
The Bible is pretty clear. Christians are also sinners. We remain sinners and therefore in need of the forgiveness of sins found only in Jesus Christ until we die, or Jesus comes back again and we are transformed into his full likeness. Does this mean that Christians commit every sin there is possible? No, but it does mean that we remain sinners. Even the apostle bemoans his sinful state and finds his solace solely in the mercy of Jesus Christ. So how is it that some are teaching that Christians stop sinning, that they are, if they're really Christians, sinless? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's time for This Week in Pop Christianity with Pastor Chris Roseborough. We're going to talk about William Hinn's teaching on Christian sinlessness. Chris is pastor of Consfinger Lutheran Church in Oslo, Minnesota, and creator and host of the YouTube channel Fighting for the Faith. Chris, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back, Todd.
The name Hinn is familiar to a lot of people. Usually it's Benny Hinn, a very famous and rather odd televangelist. Is William any relation?
Yes, he is. William Hinn is the son of Benny Hinn's brother, William Hinn, Dr. William Hinn. So William Hinn, the one we're listening to, is the nephew of Benny Hinn.
What kind of a church does William Hinn serve?
So this is a brand new church endeavor that William Hinn and a fellow by the name of Todd White, he had a ministry that he's been doing down in Texas called Lifestyle Christianity, and it's been acting as a quasi-church for some time, but let's just say that Todd White doesn't have real super pastor skills, and so he and William Hinn have joined forces, and Lifestyle Christianity has kind of molded into and been enfolded into this new endeavor. And the name of the church is Risen Nation Church. And it is kind of all the talk and the rage within the NAR right now. There's a lot of buzz regarding Risen Nation Church and all their claims regarding themselves, as far as that they are a unique church designed to kind of restore things that have been lost to Christianity, and that they're going to be a church that's going to be an example of what it means to be on fire and be burning ones for Jesus. This is all in their language and their rhetoric.
Okay, Risen Nation Church, Texas. First time I've heard of it, and I live in Texas. But if it's all the rage within that particular movement, then what we will probably do, and if anybody would like to help me out, because I'm not going to be able to do any research currently, but if you can help find maybe the website for Risen Nation Church here in Texas, find a link where we can download sermons, let me know, and we'll start reviewing some sermons. Or you can look through, go find Risen Nation Church, start looking through the sermons, and find the one that you think I should review. Okay, just go look through the titles and go, and if it's a series, then send me a link to the first sermon in the series, And then we'll just start with the first one, and we'll do a little review of Risen Nation Church and what they are actually preaching, and we'll review an entire sermon so that no one can accuse us of taking anything out of context or you know, misconstruing their words or misrepresenting them, and we'll allow them to speak for themselves while we review it and critique it. So Risen Nation Church, if it's all the rage, if it's all the buzz right now, then, well, we have a responsibility to know. I mean, that's one of the responsibilities, not only as a pastor, to make sure your sheep knows the dangers that are out there, but it's important for all of us as Christians to know what's happening within the world of Christianity, and in trying to determine if is it true, is it false, and in warning people about it. You know, ignorance, you can be ignorant of a movement within Christianity. That doesn't stop it from being influential and having an impact. So it's better to be knowledgeable so that we can identify its influence if it is as influential, or we don't know how influential this particular group is currently, but if it's all the rage right now, then we definitely want to find out a little bit more about it. So if you can do any of that research for me this morning, email me newsif@yahoo.com, newsif@yahoo.com, and we'll make that a priority and see if we can start looking into this and see what we can discover.
Eric, and so, yeah, he's part of this new endeavor, and it's just basically a hotbed of real legitimate heresy.
Is that the same Todd White who, I think about a year or two ago, was making all kinds of claims of healing that were unsubstantiated?
Yes. He's most famous for traveling around the world and lengthening people's legs, claiming that the Lord has told me to take a look at your legs, and wouldn't you know it, one leg is shorter than the other. And so by the power of the Holy Spirit, apparently he is able to take people's ailing leg problem and bring them to be equidistant. And he's just a flim-flam scammer is the best way I could put that.
We're going to hear it from William Hann himself, but how would you describe, you mentioned NAR, that's the New Apostolic Reformation.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe Hann's theology?
As a hot mess. It's a blend between kind of old school prosperity preaching that you and I, have been familiar with over the last few decades, blended with NAR dominionism, and now with a super heavy dose of this idea of like Christian sinlessness, that, you know, that if you truly are in love for God and burning for him, then sin won't even be an issue. So you got Pelagianism, false signs, false wonders, dominionism, and prosperity all kind of rolled up into one big bundle of yuck.
What are we going to hear?
All right, Pelagianism, that's very important. Now, we have covered Pelagianism. We went through, what, the 18, 19 points of Pelagianism. Pelagianism, I've stated it so many times, even though Pelagianism was condemned to heresy in church history, Pelagianism ultimately won. Pelagianism ultimately won because there are so many Christians out there who, even though they may say they're not Pelagian, Pelagianism shows up over and over in a lot of people's thinking. I think there's just something. I think it's because of our sinful nature. One of the elements of the sinful nature is I think one of the things sinful nature does is it makes us have a higher opinion of ourselves than we should. Sinful nature leads us to elevate human beings. It's to exalt ourselves. That's one of the essence of sin. It exalts ourselves. And so the last thing you want to do is see humanity as being totally depraved and completely dead in their trespasses and sins. You've got to give us some kind of ability. So I think that's very important. And thank you, Twyla. Twyla is obviously listening and already has sent me a link to Risen Nation Church. She sent me a link, it looks like, to the Apple podcast. All right, and there's the pod page for Risen Nation Church. All right, so we will definitely, I'll start looking at all of that. Thank you very much, Twyla. She's already helping us out. That's going to be something we're going to be working on, and we'll see how that goes. But let's get back to this. Just please note, Pelagianism. Now, I understand you get all the prosperity gospel and a lot of the charismatic stuff thrown in. But when I hear Pelagianism, that to me is a serious issue. And here's the reason why. I think a lot of people who are not that theologically informed can clearly see and identify charismatic influence, right? They can see, oh, it's got that healing, it's got this. They may even be able to identify prosperity. But I think there are a lot of Christians who don't have enough theological knowledge, who may not even recognize or even identify Pelagianism. In other words, they can see the other stuff and go, okay, I reject that, but they may drink in the Pelagian aspect of it because they're not familiar with it. And I mean, just ask yourself, if you've been going to church for any length of time, how many sermons have you heard on Pelagianism or semi-Pelagianism? Could you even identify the 16, 17, 18 points of Pelagianism? Now, people in my church should be able to do so because we've covered it now multiple times. But if you go to church and you've never heard a sermon on Pelagianism ever, I'm telling you, that is a bad sign. That is a really, really bad sign, because Pelagianism is an absolute heresy that has to be identified and it has to be condemned, and everyone should be able to identify what it is. And because I will hear Christians talk, and I'm like, that's straight up Pelagianism, that's semi-Pelagianism. But they either don't care or just roll their eyes and like, whatever. No, it's not a whatever. It's a heresy. All right. So, all right, let's get back into this. Again, trying to hurry.
First from him.
So in order to set the table here, we're listening to a sermon about God's rest. So this is his interpretation of the Sabbath and God's rest. And he's going to do a divergent point in the middle of his sermon where he's going to reference Mark 4 and then the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 14, respectively talking about two different storms. And it's in the second soundbite where he'll go deep into Pelagianism, but he's setting the foundation here. And I think we should pay attention to how he's doing things. There's a particular allegorical way in which he's approaching the scriptures, but then he also creates his own fabricated definitions of Greek words.
I love it because Jesus, I think, gives us a picture of this in Mark chapter 4 when he's asleep. Remember, he's in the stern of the boat. All the waves are beating on the ship and the disciples are scared and afraid, even though the King of Glory is with them, and they don't realize it. Where does it say that out of our innermost being, that he's going to dwell in our innermost being, that rivers of living water will come out of our innermost being? So Jesus is in the innermost part of this ship representing humanity. And everything in the world is coming against the ship, but God is within you in the innermost part at rest. And they couldn't tap into that frequency. They had to wake him up. I find it interesting that the waves and the lightning and everything that they probably heard didn't wake him up, but the voice of his disciples woke him up. And they're afraid and they're fearful, and he rebukes them and the storm. And they're amazed. I mean, after everything that they had seen, they're still like, okay, maybe he is who he says he is. I know he raised the dead, but I know he's continually healed me. I know that he's continually blessed. I know there's never been a day where I don't have food, but I'm still complaining about money. And God is at rest in the innermost being, and we're still like, God? And he wakes up and he rebukes it. And that word rebuke in Greek in Mark chapter 4 says he raises the standard of the storm. He calls it to a higher place, actually. It says he called it down and honored it all at the same time, which means, like, anyone have kids in here? Anyone say this statement ever? Come on, you know better than that. I mean, as parents, we hope that they know better than that. Come on, you were raised better than this. That's what, when you rebuke somebody, what you're saying is you're better than that. So he stands up and he looks at the storm and says, you're better than that. And the storm obeys him, because it heard a frequency that wasn't attached to the restlessness that creation is growing through. Told the disciples, you're better than this. Who lied to you?
Okay, let's deal with what you called his fabricated Greek definitions first. Yeah. He said that the word for rebuke in that account means he honored them and kind of put them in their place by raising them up to a higher level.
Right. So the Greek word there, the verb is epitemao, and it means to express strong disapproval of someone or to rebuke or to reprove or to censure or to warn or to prevent an action or to bring one to an end. That's what the word epitomao means. And so he created his own definition. His definition is to raise it to a higher standard. And the reason he did this here is to actually not address what Jesus said to the storm. Jesus said to the storm, "Peace, be still." This is the ESV translation of these words, and it roughly translates as that. It's very strong language. Jesus imperatively tells the storm to stop storming. But what William Hinn is doing here is, by giving us a false definition of the word rebuke, he's now changed the content of what Jesus said. And rather than saying, "Peace, be still," now Jesus is saying to the storm, as well as to his disciples, "Come on, guys, you're better than this." And if you were to think about it, that same word rebuke is used throughout the New Testament. One of the occurrences occurs in the book of Jude, where it talks about the fact that Michael the archangel, arguing with the devil over the body of Moses, did not issue a strong rebuke, but said, "The Lord rebuke you." And if we take this false definition seriously, then what Michael the archangel said to the devil was, "Come on, Satan, you're better than this," which makes no sense at all. And so now we're off to the races, if you would, because...
Okay, before we take off on the races, this is so important. This is why I know I irritate a lot of people with the way I do this, but almost any time I refer to anything in the Greek, I have everyone look up the Blue Letter Bible app, and I literally take it and play the actual word. If you listen online, you may not realize what's happening, but during a sermon, I literally hold my iPad up to the lapel mic and play the actual word. I do that because I want everyone, first of all, I'm trying to get everyone to go look it up for themselves. I'm trying to, and everyone in my church, I always say, grab your device, look up the Blue Letter Bible app, look it up. I want everyone to look it up. And the reason I do this, and I literally play them, the Blue Letter Bible app saying the word, as one, well, because I'll make sure I want to say it correctly, but I really want to get everyone from not just being a passive listener to going, "Oh, that's what the Greek word means," but literally always going to look it up for themselves, because I cannot count to you how many times I have heard preachers literally make up what a word means in the Greek or Hebrew. It's unethical. Let me make it very clear. There are times where you're preaching and you'll go, oh yeah, and you're just going from memory. Oh yeah, that means something in the Greek. I understand that sometimes when maybe you're just throwing it out by memory and you get it wrong, I can accept that we're not perfect and we make mistakes. But when that Greek word is like key to your entire sermon and you're telling people this is what the word means in the Greek and this starts building your entire argument, and you are clearly getting it wrong, that makes me question, like, you're doing that on purpose. Like, how did you come to the conclusion that that's what that means in the Greek when it doesn't? So what I try to do, if I make a reference to anything in the Greek or Hebrew, especially now, I'll just grab the iPad, open up the Blue Letter Bible app, and I literally play the word for everyone, and then we go through Strong's definition, the outline of biblical usage. We may even look down at the Thayer's lexicon. We may look at all the different ways it's used. We really try to dig in, and I do that to try to prevent that from happening, what you just saw. And again, what we just heard, I mean, that to me seems absolutely intentional and on purpose, because this is what he's using to base his argument as he moves forward, which is going to be some kind of Pelagian argument, obviously, about people. It sounds like that, hey, we're better than that because I guess we're not totally depraved. I don't know where he's going to go. I've got my suspicions. But if he's using this Greek word, or if he's making up this Greek definition, then this is done on purpose. And one of the easy ways to protect yourself from being deceived is whenever you listen to a sermon and they say anything about the Greek or Hebrew, go look it up. D- download the Blue Letter Bible app. It's absolutely free. Now, I know some people who've got extensive, maybe multiple degrees in Greek or Hebrew will laugh at that approach, but that at least gives you, I understand there's a lot more to understanding a language than simply looking it up like that. I understand that. But I'm telling you, it gives you the basics so that you can protect yourself. I hate to say this. Never trust a pastor or a Christian book when they tell you something means this in the Greek or Hebrew. Never trust it. I hate to say that, but you cannot trust. Don't even trust me. And one of the reasons what I try to do is you're not trusting me. You're trusting what the Blue Letter Bible app says or whichever app that I'm using at the time. And I usually tell you which app that I'm using. Don't trust yourself, okay? Go look at different sources, all right? We got to hurry. Let's see if we can at least get to the basic parts of this argument, and then we can come back to this maybe this afternoon.
These people are trusting this man that he's actually studied the Greek language and that these definitions that he's giving of these words, here the word rebuke, that that's really what that means, and that the real meaning of the scriptures locked up in that definition. But what he said is not only spurious, it's completely fabricated.
Pastor Chris Roseborough is our guest. It's This Week in Pop Christianity. We're talking about William Hinn's teaching on Christian sinlessness. He also said that Jesus was speaking on a different frequency. What does that mean?
All right, we're going to have to stop there because they're going to go to a commercial break, and I don't have the commercials edited out, and we can't play the commercials. So instead of sitting here trying to figure out where it starts, that just makes a perfect transition for the part two, whenever we can get to part two, because we'll just advance it past the commercials and just come right back in, and we'll go there. So we didn't get to the fact of what they mean by, I kind of see where they're going, because if rebuke simply means, hey, you're better than that, then when you rebuke anyone, you're saying, hey, you can be better than that, almost giving the idea, and maybe they're going to use it this way, I could be wrong, because I haven't, remember, I don't review anything first because I don't like to rehearse my responses, but my feeling is it's going to be like, hey, see, we're all better. We can be better. We can be without fear. We can be without sin. We can do these things. And I know a lot of Christians hold to that, but we all strive against the flesh. We have to fight the flesh. We want to sin less, but we can never be sinless. We will always sin because the sin nature remains. The sin nature is not eradicated. The sin nature remains inside of us. So we will continue to sin. So when we come across a passage like 1 John 3:9, which seems, and let me read it again. 1 John 3:9, which reads, whosoever is born of God doth not commit sin. We have to figure out what in the world that, what is that talking about? How do we interpret that, and how do we understand it? Because here's the one thing I know. I know I sin, I know you sin, and we all sin in some way, shape, or form. Because think about it. Sin is really any lack of conformity to the holiness of God in thought, word, deed, or desire. And we will never be as holy as God, ever. So that means we are continually living in sin constantly. So should that mean that we don't try to strive against it? No, we should strive against it because God commands us to. But that's why, listen, if we could be sinless, then we would not need Christ. But because we are sinful, then we constantly are in need of his imputed righteousness, his mercy, and his forgiveness. Now, I wanted to get a little further here, but this is the perfect place to stop. And we'll try to get back to this afternoon. But this is going. I wanted to get more to the discussion about them claiming this discussion of sinless Christianity. But at least we got a little bit here of the danger of listening to people tell you what something means in the Greek. I hate that you can't trust anyone, but you literally cannot trust anyone when they give you the Greek. I don't care who they are. You can't. You have to go look it up. You have to look it up. And I wish it wasn't that way. And the reason I wish it wasn't that way is because obviously you can't expect every person in your church to go spend years studying Greek and Hebrew. You just can't. You can't, like, hey, I know you're a carpenter, but what you need to do in the evenings is get an advanced degree in Greek. Yeah, you can't expect that. So you wish that you could trust people within Christianity, but you just can't. And whenever someone is manipulating the Greek or Hebrew in order to advance their theological position, that means they care more about their theological position than they do truth. And that is, well, that's sinful. Okay, that's sinful. So, which is kind of ironic that if he just misrepresented that on purpose, then that's deceit and that's sinful. And if he's getting ready to make some kind of claim about sinless Christianity, he just already demonstrated sinfulness. Because no matter, whenever Christians out there try to tell everyone that they are sinless, trust me, it will only take a couple of seconds and you will see the sinfulness if you'll look and if they would look and if everybody would be honest, because it's there. But all right, I didn't get as far as I wanted, but that's a good place to stop. And we'll come back in and do this, hopefully today. I don't know. I don't know how this afternoon is going to work out, but we will see what we can get accomplished. All right. So there you have it. And about 20 minutes, we'll be live under the Theology Central podcast, and we'll be doing a Bible study exercise in 1 John. We'll be looking at 1 John 3:9, and I think this will all ultimately fit in, and then we'll start doing some reviews of this Risen Nation Church located here in Texas, and we'll see what they're all about, and we'll see what we should review and try to get a basic idea of what's going on there. So we had a lot of things to work on, as always. More things to cover than time to, I need more like 48 hours in every day. I don't know. I need 72 hours in every day. I need more time. So there you have it. A lot to talk about. Your thoughts about any of this, email me newsif@yahoo.com. newsif@yahoo.com. All right. I got to stop before people start walking in. All right, everyone have a great morning. We'll be back live here in about 20 minutes and have 1 John 3 ready to go. And it should be an interesting conversation. All right, thanks for listening. God bless.